Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including unique baby gifts with custom baby bedding and accessories, Brownfield Sports, and Cardinal Fitness on the web at cardinalfitness.com.
The song This Could Be the Start of Something Big, a tune written by Steve Allen in 1956, a song that would eventually become his theme song. Good afternoon, this is The Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jason Croft, your guest host for this hour of the program. Musician, comedian, writer, actor, Steve Allen was truly a Renaissance man and one of early television's big innovators. He, more than anyone else, helped define late-night television. That's according to author Ben Alba. The monologue, the desk, crazy characters, and wacky stunts, the whole late-night format was created, for the most part, by Allen. Alba talks about Steve Allen and early late-night television in his new book, Inventing Late Night, Steve Allen and the Original Tonight Show. It's published by Prometheus Books. Ben Alba teaches legal writing and co-directs the Bar Passage Program at DePaul University College of Law in Chicago. I spoke with Alba last month about Inventing Late Night. This interview is an extended interview of one that aired on this month's edition of Sidetrack, a program I host the first Saturday of each month at 5 p.m. Since this is pre-recorded, we will not be taking your phone calls today. To start the interview, I first asked Alba how Steve Allen's Tonight Show came to be.
It really was more of an evolution from his days in early radio into early television. And it wasn't so much that he sat down and decided, well, I think I'm going to have a desk here, and I'm going to go out into the audience there and then have these celebrity guests and all that. But it was just different elements that came about. And just to give an example, the work that he was doing in radio was pretty much what everybody else was doing at the time in the 1940s, which was heavily scripted, very tightly scripted programs. And he'd be slavishly writing everything he was going to say on the air the night before. And he wanted to take the lazy way out, he admitted later on, and he thought that maybe if he could start interviewing people, interviewing celebrities in particular, that that might be a better way out. And in fact, it was a lot less work for him to do, he discovered. And that went pretty well, and he started having audiences come in to the shows that he was doing and start watching him. And this was really something that he didn't really devise as much as people wanted to drop in, and he just started letting more and more people come by. And one night, the celebrity interview format was working pretty well until the one night that Doris Day, who was the scheduled guest because of a mix-up, didn't show up. And he found himself with 20 minutes of air to fill and what to do. I mean, he played both sides of her record, and he was wondering, well, maybe I could take this clunky floor mic, and you know, this really heavy thing with an iron stand and all, and bring it into the audience and maybe interview all of you nice people here. And so he found out, rather by happenstance, that a nice little exchange with somebody in the audience, maybe with a little bit of wit, would generate a far bigger laugh than the best scripted line with Bob Hope. So spontaneity, I think, was one thing that he had going for him, along with a great sense of curiosity about how things worked and about people. In fact, at one point, the station bosses at the Los Angeles radio station where he was doing the show were frowning on him because they told him, well, we hired you to play records. And he told his audience that, and they actually had a huge mail-in campaign to tell the station to please let Steve Allen keep talking and interviewing and being more ad-libby and spontaneous. And so he decided, as it became more and more successful, to take that element with him into early television. And so he ended up getting a show, and I mentioned earlier, doing so successfully in radio out in L.A., but then he ended up getting a local late-night show in New York City on WNBT, which was the predecessor station to WNBC. And it was a show that had evolved mainly out of his Hollywood radio show. So it had an opening monologue, and it had Steve sitting, instead of at a table where he did in the studio, now they gave him a desk, and he would interview celebrities. He would go out into the audience, interview people there, take the cameras out onto the street, engage in some wild stunts and comedy sketches. And that was the show that one of the NBC network bosses, Pat Weaver, had been watching at some point around 1953. And this is at a time where Weaver was trying to convince his bosses that there would be some revenue potential in opening up late night for network television. They'd already tried a show on NBC called Broadway Open House, which was a lot of vaudeville shtick, and it ran only for about a year and a half. But then after that, Weaver saw this local Steve Allen show going on, and he began to notice, gee, this is kind of a nice, loose, zany kind of television show, informal. Maybe this is what we need to close our network programming day with. And he approached Steve and asked, you know, could we take your local Steve Allen show and put it on the full NBC network and change the name to Tonight? And Steve said, fine. And so in September of 1954, that was the very first Tonight Show starring Steve Allen, and the rest is history.
One of the amazing things that you bring out in the book is, well, one, the evolution from the radio show to his New York show to the network show. You know, all along the way, it was primarily Steve Allen doing everything with a very small supporting production cast.
He had no writers on the local late night show. And the station manager thought that was great because it's a lot cheaper. So they thought that was a great economic boost for them. And then even the first, the initial stages of the Tonight Show, when Steve went on the full network, only had one writer and at most had only about three. So most of these programs were focusing or centered largely around Steve Allen's ad-lib ability. And you could even have him do... It was a great story about him doing a live on-the-air commercial demonstration of one of the indestructible materials of the time, fiberglass. And he would take the sledgehammer and bang it against a fiberglass chair and show how unbreakable it was. And this demonstration worked out pretty well a few times on a few nights, until one night, for whatever inexplicable reason, Steve's sledgehammer shattered the fiberglass chair into hundreds of little pieces. And Steve, without missing a beat, said, well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen, just as you suspected, this sledgehammer is made of fiberglass. You could see just how quick the guy's mind was.
Well, that's one thing that really comes across in the book, is his mastery of living in the moment and knowing precisely how to react and what to say.
And it wasn't so much that he was working at it, but it was just that because he loved spontaneity, he almost prayed for things to go wrong. Because whenever anything would go wrong, it would challenge his creativity and probably spark something within him that could take it one level higher. And if anything, Tom Poston, one of the comic actors that I interviewed for the book, was fond of emphasizing that if everything went according to the script, Steve Allen would get bored. Not that he wanted you to turn the script upside down, but if there was a little bit of a variation or something that was just not quite exactly the way it was supposed to go, he would be just as much a reactor or somebody in the audience as much as he would be an actor.
On a typical night, if you tuned in to The Tonight Show, what sort of things would you see? You mentioned his ad-libbing. You know, we talked about how, you know, he would go into the audience, open up the back doors. What other sorts of things would you see from him?
Well, he'd be entertaining exotic animals that would come on the show. Sometimes it might be an elephant or a tarantula. He had a show, actually, that predated Tonight that had, as a regular, a live llama. Can you imagine that? They were really looking for talent then. but took the cameras outside the studio, do stunts, have fun with newspapers. He'd have a fake mind-reading character on the show, that he would play himself. Some of the more strange guests, he had one, just to give a couple of examples, when he would take the show on the road to such cities as Miami Beach, and The Tonight Show was one of the first shows to go on the road. One of the guests that he would have was a lady named Mrs. Diehl, D-I-E-H-L, and her laughing parrots. And these parrots that she would bring along with her just had this knack for laughing on far longer than you ever wanted them to. They were probably about the most annoying laughing parrots you could have, and it was wild. It was just really wild to have them on. And then he had a guy named Joe Interlegi, who appeared rather frequently, and he had a knack for being able to do all kinds of unusual things, like pulling trucks using his ears and eating wood and balancing very hefty-sized human beings using his teeth. It was just one of these novelty kinds of people, very unusual, that everybody would be curious to see what they could do.
So sometimes the stars of his show weren't the Hollywood stars. They were just ordinary people.
Yeah, and in fact, that's where he found that you could really mine the audience for found humor, or you could be able to go outside up and down the street and there's found humor. I think that maybe people are able to identify that. In fact, one of the writers that I interviewed, Stan Burns, said that if he had a good line, let's say if Steve Allen had a good comedic exchange with, say, Henry Fonda, in Stan's words, that was normal. You'd expect that because Henry Fonda, even though he was a serious actor, could probably do comedy reasonably well because he was a trained professional. But when you can get ordinary people on there and have fun with them, and have fun with them not at their expense, but have fun with them, and that was a rare trait that a number of people have identified with Steve, that you could gain tremendous success. Not only would viewers like the show, but the people in the audience would feel more relaxed because they knew Steve wasn't going to take advantage of them, but he was treating them all with a great deal of respect, but yet finding a lot of humor that was within them.
That's a very modern concept, the idea of found humor. You know, working without a net, working without a script. And,
right.
You know, most people can't pull that off. But Steve Allen, as you say in the book, did tremendously well. Another element to the show was the musical element, particularly jazz. Played a big part in his show. And I suspect that's because Allen was a musician himself. Is that true? Am I getting close to that?
Yeah, he was. He learned to play piano when he was a child. He never really read music very well. But he became a great jazz pianist as well as a great jazz aficionado. And he grew up, a lot of his growing up years, even though he was the product of a traveling vaudevillian family that would go around the country, but a lot of his growing up years were spent up in the Chicago area. And he would go to places such as the Panther Room in the Sherman House to hear people like Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong and Art Tatum, Errol Garner, Oscar Peterson, Benny Goodman, these were all his heroes as he was growing up. And so when he was finally able to get a late-night television show where he could showcase some of these great artists, he was able to put many of them on. And, in fact, not only put them on, but oftentimes play with them. There was one recollection that the producer of the show, Bill Harbach, had where they did a live concert at Birdland with Count Basie, and Count Basie would play a number, and then he had Steve sit in with the band, which Steve found to be exhilarating. And in fact, he even told his producer it felt like, you know, once you hear the Count Basie orchestra and all that brass surrounding you, would you feel like you're being picked up by the back of your jacket and lifted up into the air? It must have been a really exhilarating experience for him.
And one of the amazing things is he brought these musicians on because he loved them, the big jazz guys.
Oh, and I ought to interject that in the middle of all that, he played Benny Goodman in one of his few films, The Benny Goodman Story, opposite Donna Reed. So that was really the chance of a lifetime that he had, and that was a film that came out in 1955.
Well, yeah, no doubt Steve Allen loved jazz, and he loved the people who did it. And what was very interesting in the book is he was bringing on African-American performers and putting them in his show prominently to an extent that no one else had really done before.
In fact, this is during an era when they weren't necessarily welcome on television, and I had some rather interesting and I would probably say poignant insights from people like Bobby Short. It was probably one of the last interviews that he gave before he passed away in March of 2005. And Bobby was saying that television, if you put yourself back in that era when it was new, television was at the time the only medium where you could see people in your bedroom and you're wearing your pajamas. And network executives at the time were very cautious about what might be offensive to viewers. And in Bobby's words, if, say, Pepsodent wanted to sponsor a show and that show had black people and black people were anathema to the viewers, then that probably wouldn't be a very good show to sponsor. And I had Diane Carroll and Eartha Kitt recounting to me about how they might be scheduled to be appearing on a nighttime television show, and the producer would tell them, well, we're going to have to wait another week because we've already got Sammy Davis Jr. on this week, so you'll have to wait another week to come over to do our show. Steve Allen never took that approach, and they all remarked about how colorblind his approach was to entertainment, and that if he liked an artist and he respected their artistry, he would invite that person to come on. And it was a huge opportunity, particularly in the African-American community, that it was really quite exciting that they would see a black performer on national TV, and that you would get so many of these greats. Some of the people that I already mentioned, like Errol Garner and Art Tatum and Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong even recorded a Steve Allen Christmas song called Cool Yule, which continues to be a standard today. I think it was even recorded last year by the Brian Setzer Orchestra. So, there's really a lot of connections to the modern world that Steve Allen continues to have.
And besides being groundbreaking in that way, he was also groundbreaking in that he would bring his politics into the show.
That's true. He would have the Tonight Show, let's put it this way, the Tonight Show under Steve Allen was not as heavily slanted on comedy, although there was a lot of it there. It was quite more of a variety show, and on some nights, not too many, but on some nights, Steve would turn the show into something a bit more serious, where he would have panel discussions on whether it be race relations or McCarthyism, which was really a big story at the time, or civil rights. He wasn't afraid to take political stands, and even got hate mail one night after he kissed Lena Horne on the air, just gave her a casual kiss on the cheek and after her song, and he decided to read this piece of hate mail from the viewer and literally chastised the viewer on the air and say, this guy needs to go to a hospital, and went on a diatribe against racism.
In the back of your book, you include a list of people who appeared on his shows, notable actors, singers, comedians, writers, public figures. It is a regular who's who of basically everybody who was important in the mid-20th century. Were there some names that surprised you?
I didn't expect until I learned about it in doing research for the book, people like Carl Sandburg or great athletes that might have been in the Olympics or some of these, a lot of these other, just the jazz section alone, the section of all the musicians there, I couldn't believe. But as Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet were telling me, he had such a great love for that American art form. And it was still relatively new at that time that he couldn't wait to have people go on there. And he wanted to expose America to matters of social and cultural importance. So it's amazing that there, in my view, was more depth to the roster of guests that he had on that show, more so than, let's say, the mainly A-list comedians or actors that tend to predominate in a lot of the late-night shows today.
Now, you brought up the name Carl Sandburg, and you recount his appearance on The Tonight Show, which seems to be one of the most unusual appearances or guests that, that Steve Allen had. Why don't you sort of explain what happened during that interview?
Well, it was an appearance that probably ran far longer than it was actually supposed to be scheduled, but Steve Allen's producer, Bill Harbach, who was the son of the great Broadway librettist Otto Harbach, Otto knew Carl Sandburg. They were great friends for many years, and because of that connection, the son, Bill, was able to invite Carl to come on the show, and Carl Sandburg was just delighted to do so, and they had scheduled him for a 10-minute interview with Steve. And for whatever reason, Carl became very comfortable sitting there at the desk next to Steve, and Steve saw the clock running out and began to very politely thank Carl for dropping by and maybe dropping a few hints about that the segment is coming to an end. But Carl never really took the clue, and he began reading from his Lincoln biographies, and he began doing more things there, and the show kept on going, and the audience could tell that Steve was gently trying to pry Carl off the stage. But then Steve decided to kind of roll with it, and that, I again, is part of his genius, that he very good-naturedly kidded about the fact that Carl was still on stage, but then wanted to have him continue. And by the end of the show, Carl had been given a guitar to play, and Carl played guitar, and I never knew he did that. And they did a great duet on the song Home on the Range. I mean, who would ever think that that night would have been scripted? You know, it's just not like that. It just was what Steve Allen was able to create on the spot using somebody that was just being himself. And it turned out to be one of our great poets and great American icons, Carl Sandburg, being on a show like The Tonight Show.
You're listening to a pre-recorded interview with Ben Alba, author of Inventing Late Night, Steve Allen, and the original Tonight Show. It's published by Prometheus Books. Just a reminder, since this afternoon's program is not live, we won't be taking your phone calls today. Now back to our discussion about Steve Allen and the early Tonight Show. In 1956, Steve Allen started also doing a Sunday night comedy variety show while still keeping his duties on The Tonight Show.
Talk about multitasking.
Wow. That must have been an amazing amount of work for Allen to do.
You know, I don't think he thought at the beginning that it was going to be that much work. And the reason is that when he was doing The Tonight Show, he found that doing a show where it's mostly ad-lib and spontaneity, it wasn't that difficult for him to do. It came very naturally for him, even though this is five nights a week at 90 minutes. And with regard to writing that show, it would be maybe about 10% written and 90% ad-libbed. When he accepted this offer of NBC to front a Sunday night comedy hour, and this was supposed to go on opposite Ed Sullivan because NBC was desperate for some real competition for Ed Sullivan, who literally owned Sunday nights, they tapped Steve Allen. And that's when Steve discovered that the writing proportions and the amount of work was actually the opposite of doing a spontaneous late-night show, where almost 90% of the Steve Allen primetime show was going to have to be written and rehearsed and scripted very tightly, and then the other 10% could be ad-libbed. So that, if anything, it required probably a lot more work to do this one-hour comedy show than it would just to be able to breeze through The Tonight Show as well as Steve Allen did it. And so he cut back his Tonight duties to three nights a week and kept the primetime show, but then even with that, it proved too much. So after he did the primetime show for about 6 or 7 months, he decided to leave Tonight and focus on primetime because at the time, I mean, late-night television was still new territory. And they didn't think that they were going to attract that many more than, let's say, 3 to 5 million viewers on a good night for late night, whereas with network primetime, you'd be talking between 30 and 40 million. So it made a lot of sense for Steve to move into that arena. And I think that's how he became really well-known and established around the country when everybody was able to see him earlier on Sunday nights.
Well, you mentioned that he was going up against Ed Sullivan, who was the, the juggernaut of, yeah, of TV ratings, and Steve Allen held his own.
Oh yeah, you know, the first show that he had against Ed, I think, had doubled the ratings of the show that had preceded Steve's on NBC, and then by the second week, Steve had had Elvis Presley on the show, and that show actually beat Ed Sullivan in the ratings that night. I mean, it would almost be like some unknown new show comes up and beats American Idol, and in fact knocks it off of the top 20 shows that week. It was just unheard of. They didn't think anything like that was going to happen. And although Ed, on average, won the battle, there were a number of times that Steve either came up alongside him or actually overtook him. And it was extremely respectable of a showing that he made.
Now, on this Sunday primetime show, there were a great number of soon-to-be very famous TV comedians. They made their big break with the Steve Allen primetime show. Tell us who was on that cast and what they brought into the show.
Well, Louis Nye was one. Louis Nye actually had quite a bit of experience on Steve Allen's local late-night show and on the early Tonight Show, but really became quite a fixture as one of the three men on the street that was a running gag that was a classic on the weekly Steve Allen show. And Louis's characters tended to be more over-the-top, and he played... One of them was this rather flamboyant advertising man named Gordon Hathaway that coined the catchphrase of the era, "Hi-ho, Steve Areno," and that was what he was famous for. Then we had Tom Poston, who was the guy that never really could remember his name, no matter how you asked for it, and Tom did a great job doing that. And up until then, he said he had had just about every kind of acting job you could imagine, including Broadway, but never the exposure. So he said only, you know, after all these years in the business, only his family knew how great he was. But then once, with 1 week on the Steve Allen show, he became a household name. And cab drivers were honking at him, and people were stopping him on the street. And it was a huge break for him. And he never thought that a character that couldn't remember his name would catch on, and that became a staple for him. So that was amazing. And then Don Knotts, probably the most famous of the three. He actually got his start doing a monologue of a nervous character on The Tonight Show, and that became so successful that he was invited to join the cast of the Steve Allen show, and really did quite a number with these nervous characters, and one of my favorite ones where he would introduce himself as... something like, "My name is D.D. Morrison, and I'm the bodyguard for Vice President Nixon." And in that trembly voice of his, it was just really funny. And Steve would ask him, "Well, what do the initials D.D. stand for?" And Don would answer, "Duck, Dick." It was just great, because he caught on so well that naturally led to his opportunity to become cast for the very classic role of Barney Fife on the Andy Griffith Show.
Now, there were some other interesting characters that were developed during this primetime show that became cultural icons of the era.
Jose Jimenez, I think.
That's one I was thinking of, yeah.
That was played by Bill Dana. Bill Dana originally started as a writer on The Tonight Show, and this was in 1956 when Steve was asked to do the primetime show. He had to end up diverting the two writers that he had on The Tonight Show into the Sunday Show, and so they were looking for new writers, and Bill Dana was one that they hired. And then eventually Bill also did work on The Sunday Show, and at that time developed a character named Jose Jimenez, who was kind of like a Walter Mitty. He played different kinds of roles. And he was different kinds of people there. He might be the captain of a submarine, or I think in his most famous character, he was an astronaut. And I think that was probably just at the right time, because the space program was just starting to get off the ground, literally, and he became Jose Jimenez the astronaut. I think there was another, I think they still have this clip where he was a Santa Claus, a teacher in a Santa Claus school, and he was trying to explain with his accent how you do the famous Santa Claus laugh, and it was spelled J-O-J-O-J-O.
You know, Steve Allen did this primetime show, and then he basically did several other series after this. Meanwhile, The Tonight Show has Jack Parr, and then, of course, Johnny Carson, who takes over the helm for the next 25 years. And in your book, you sort of hint at a feud between Steve Allen and Johnny Carson. In particular, you compare how some of Johnny Carson's famous characters were based on Steve Allen's characters that he used on The Tonight Show.
Yeah, I'm not sure if the word feud is maybe a little bit strong.
Well, that's kind of what I wanted to find out here. Is it what really was a feud, or if it just was, you know what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah, they were actually quite cordial throughout their lives. And in fact, on many occasions, Steve would pop up as a guest on Johnny's show, sometimes would even guest host the show for Johnny as well. But Steve always liked it when people would give him credit or just acknowledge or give a nod to him with regard to anything that they wanted to either borrow from him or anything that he had done that they would take to another level. So, for example, like Jay Leno had Steve on the 40th anniversary Tonight Show broadcast, and Jay was regaling him with stories of how jaywalking or the funny headlines were all based on things that Steve Allen had done. And Steve was he would be like a proud grandpa, or even when David Letterman would do the same thing, where he would say, look, you know, you brought the desk here, and a lot of the inspiration I got for my show, I got from you. And Steve would say, I like that you're taking what I've done to a new level. But what was interesting was that with Johnny Carson's people, for example, Carnac, the fake mind reader, where you had the question as the punchline. Well, 10 years before that, Steve Allen was doing a running gag called The Question Man, in which he played sort of a fake mind reader where the question was the punchline, and really pretty much the same form. But yet, whenever Steve would talk to the production team of The Tonight Show under Johnny, they would claim that, and they would insist rather independently, that Carnac was created independently of The Question Man, even though Johnny was even a guest on a number of the earlier Steve Allen shows where they were doing The Question Man. And some of the same jokes, let's say, or the same punchlines were used on Carnac that had appeared in The Question Man. So it's kind of difficult to say or to get away with being able to claim that you created one thing completely independently of the other if you at least had the exposure to it. And in fact, Steve Allen, one of Steve Allen's principal writers, Herb Sargent, was personally recruited by Johnny to write for the first year of Johnny's show in 1962.
Who do you think now has the Steve Allen brand of late night humor? Who do you think is that direct descendant?
I would say that the most direct descendant would be Dave Letterman. Dave grew up admiring Steve, and really when he got his crack at daytime television, at the urging of his director, Hal Gurney, who also directed for Jack Parr, Dave ran over to the Museum of Television and Radio in New York to kind of look up a lot of the old Steve Allen shows that Dave used to watch while he was a high school student in the 60s. And I think he got a lot of inspiration for his show from watching Steve. Even things like the Alka-Seltzer Man. Dave had gotten the inspiration for that from watching Steve Allen's Human Teabag, where Steve was emblazoned with 200 teabags, and they dumped him into this clear vat of warm water. And when Steve resurfaced, he proudly announced, "Tea is served." So all of that kind of thing, Dave really admired that, and he admired the spontaneity, and I think you see more of those elements on his show. But yet, Jay Leno, who wrote the foreword to my book, carries the Steve Allen tradition quite famously in such bits as jaywalking, very much like what Steve would do going up and down the street, interviewing and having good-natured fun with people, or the funny headlines that Jay does, and even. Let's say if we go back to Letterman, like the Stupid Petrix, you'd get a lot of animals coming up on Steve Allen shows that would be doing unpredictable things.
Now, I of course was way too young to see Steve Allen doing any of his shows. Are there any recordings out there of his Tonight Show, of his prime time show? Is there any way you can go back and see this, what he did?
Yeah, well, you know, there, unfortunately, with regard to The Tonight Show, almost all of the video evidence of that program does not exist any longer. These kinescopes were made during a time when there wasn't much archival value to these early shows. That was the mentality at the time, if you could believe that. Even if you had people like, let's say, Jackie Robinson or Lena Horne or Richard Rodgers or Carl Sandburg or Eleanor Roosevelt on your shows, television was a much more disposable era. And as that director I mentioned, Hal Gurney, said, it was like the newspaper. They treated it like that. You'd read it and then you'd pitch it. It wasn't until maybe getting into the earlier and maybe mid-1960s where they began to recognize more of a permanent value, that there was really something worth preserving in television, because Steve Allen's shows were not the only ones that were disposed of. I mean, almost all of Milton Berle's old shows, much of Jack Parr, and even most of the first 10 years of Johnny Carson. A lot of those early Carson shows were just taped over, if you could believe that. And they didn't really begin preserving them until the early 1970s. So it's just unfortunate. However, there are some shows of Steve Allen's primetime series, quite a number of those. In fact, most of them still exist. And from time to time, they get trotted out onto a cable network. And I think the last time they did that was in the early 90s on the, it was the Ha Comedy Channel, which is the predecessor to Comedy Central. And Steve actually videotaped all of the introductions and wraparounds brand new in the early 90s. And they came up with like a collection of half-hour compilations of the best of what Steve Allen had done. The Allen family, though, remains interested in seeing, for example, if this book of mine generates a new interest in Steve Allen, because they'd certainly be open to trying to put something else together in a video format if enough people if they're convinced that enough people are interested.
Well, I personally would love to see Steve Allen in action. I think from what this book says, it was just magic night after night.
It was, and maybe not to overstate it, but what was interesting about television in that time was, because it was live, everything had to count. And not everything that you would do would be drop-dead funny. And I don't think anybody could be expected to be that funny every single minute of the show. And most people would be willing to say and allow that not every moment that Steve Allen was on the air would be drop-dead funny, but Steve Allen had such a likable quality about him that, as the writer Stan Burns emphasized to me, if the audience already likes you, even before you open your mouth and say a word, then you're going to be a hit. And that was Steve Allen. Everybody liked him. So that if he was mining the audience for found humor, and he might be, let's say, up there talking to people for about 20, 25 minutes, I mean, longer than what you would see the late-night host today doing, and if he got one big laugh out of the 20 to 25 minutes he was on there, he'd be the talk of the country the next day, because everybody liked him, and it just, you know, he knew how to be able to handle audiences in that fashion.
So if you could, what would you say, in to summarize, was Steve Allen's impact on television and popular culture, and how is he looked on today, and how do you think he'll be looked on in 20 and 50 years?
He invented an original American art form. It was a format that really seemed to resonate with audiences, and maybe it was a combination of Steve Allen doing this kind of late-night zaniness, and you combine that with the genius of the programming director at NBC. His name was Pat Weaver, who had the wisdom of putting on Steve Allen late at night at a time when probably with the country winding down, looking for something loose and not too rigid, that Steve Allen offered an intimacy that was not the kind of vaudeville shtick that had prevailed earlier. It was a new kind of television. It wasn't just people performing at you, but people having conversation and comedy, and that kind of intimacy more people could relate to, and the kind of dealing with and interacting with everyday folks, people, whether they be in the audience or up and down the street. Steve Allen had a way of connecting with them, and in that way was able to connect with America.
That was Ben Alba, author of Inventing Late Night, Steve Allen, and The Original Tonight Show. It's published by Prometheus Books. This was an extended interview of one that was first aired on this month's edition of Sidetrack. To find out more about Steve Allen and his legacy, you can visit his official website at www.steveallen.com. To round out this portion of the program, a bit of musical mischief from Allen himself. This is a novelty tune he wrote and recorded in the early 1960s, incorporating one of his signature phrases. It's titled, "How's Your Sister?"
Well, hi there, mister. How's your sister? Does she still go schmuck, schmuck? Now, don't you be a fink. Tell me, what do you think of all of this crazy talk? Now, you may have heard of the surfing bird, but you'll decide that the Clyde is the real boss word. Well, hi there, mister. How's your sister? Does she still go schmuck, schmuck? Well, hi there, seal. How's your creel? Do you do that same old shtick? Now when it comes to your turn, you holler, how's your fern? Until they all say yick. Now it's the most, to say the least, to Watusi in the west, do the sloshing in the east. Oh, well, hiya there, mister, how's your sister? Does she still say schmuck, schmuck? Mister, how's your sister? Does she still go schmuck, schmuck? Now don't you be a fink. Tell me, what do you think of all this crazy talk? Now you may have heard of the serving bird, but you'll decide that the Clyde is the real boss word. Oh, well, hiya there, mister. How's your sister? Does she still go schmuck, schmuck? Oh, well, hi there, seal. How's your crib? Do you do that same old shtick? When it comes to your turn, you holler, how's your fern? Until they all say yick. Now it's the most, to say the least, to Watusi in the west and do the sloshing in the east. Well, hi there, mister, how's your sister? Does she still say schmuck, schmuck? Does she still say schmuck, schmuck? Does she still say?
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In a moment, we're going to find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade, and then we'll find out what happened today on the Merck. And then at 2:06 Central Time, Dave Dickey will have the closing market report.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's 10 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Henry Frayne. And joining us now with settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade, Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. A tough day at the Chicago Board of Trade as well as in Kansas City, where the screen is entirely red today. Over in the corn pit in Chicago, we saw corn trading through support at 218 and three quarters. That triggered a wave in the afternoon of non-commercial long liquidation. Remember, there's a lot of traders who are net long in the speculative side of the market. and they continue to liquidate their contracts today. Soybeans also retreated from highs earlier on the day. We were in the green, but we end the day in the red. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars, and we'll start in Kansas City, which was, again, some of the big losers on the day in terms of percentage of contract. May wheat a high on the day of 416, a low of 408 and a half, settling 413 and three quarters, down 7 3/4 on the day. July, a high of 418, a low of 411, settling 414 and three quarters, down 7 3/4. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, a high of 354 and a half, a low of 347 and a half, settling 350 and a quarter, down 7 1/4. July, a high of 366 and a half, a low of 359 and a half, settling 362 and a quarter, down 7 3/4. September, a high of 377 and a half, a low of 371, settling 373 and a half, down 7. December, a high of 391 and a half, a low of 385, settling 387, down 8 1/2. The red line, March, a high of 401 and a half, a low of 398, settling $4 and a half, down 6 on the day. May corn, a high of 221 and 3/4, a low of 217, settling 218 and a quarter, down 3 1/4. July, a